Please be seated. Good morning. It's a dreary day, but bright in here. I want to thank you all for coming. We have two rules hearings and then an open administrative conference. The first rules proceeding is 1107 in the matter of the petition to create a Supreme Court rule for legal services following a major disaster. The presenter will be Joseph Redding of the Board of Administrative Oversight. Mr. Redding.
Good morning. I am Joe Redding, and I'm a member of the Board of Administrative Oversight. The board has filed a petition for this court, obviously, to create Rule SCR 2303 for legal services following a determination of a major disaster. Now, the board has discussed this petition over our last four quarterly meetings, and hopefully while this would rarely be used, I think it shows that we're prepared to move forward should our jurisdiction suffer a major disaster or other jurisdictions in the United States. The board believes that this rule walks the delicate balance of providing for legal services for people in Wisconsin during catastrophic times, while ensuring that those who are providing these services are accounted for, they're supervised, and they're regulated to protect the public. I'd be happy to go into detail with the proposed rule, but I believe Keith Zillin is from the director of OLR is better able to give the details of the rules. So unless this court has any questions of me, I would ask Keith to come up here.
This only covers lawyers. Doesn't cover where courts meet, as I understand this rule.
Correct. I believe that this rule would not apply to appearing in court.
Right. And it doesn't apply moving courts from one area to the other should there be an emergency. It's nothing to do with that.
Correct.
And there are provisions in 753 about setting up courts in other jurisdictions. This doesn't affect that.
Correct.
I think that under Chapter 166, the governor has various powers in the event of a disaster. Does this interfere with the governor, or does the governor interfere with us?
I do not know the answer to that question.
Okay, we'll check. Thank you.
Thank you.
Could I ask, why don't you spell out what you conceive as a major disaster?
Certainly. The AB Commons talks about major disasters being, they gave examples, hurricane, earthquake, flood, wildfire, tornado, public health emergency, or an event caused by terrorists or acts of war. So, I believe it ranges wide. However, the determination is made by this court. So this court has control over if a emergency has occurred. And this court also has a determination when the emergency is over.
Well, I'm not expecting a hurricane. I mean, you have a list of potential events, but how would we know when this really requires the action that's permitted?
Sure. I would think probably the court will need to be assisted by news media individuals in the area. For example, a flood maybe on the Mississippi. You know, that type of situation near the Hudson area. I think then the court would have to get information from the people in the area whether or not, hey, we need help here. We're not be able to satisfy the legal needs of these people. through what we have in place because of this emergency. So I think there would be sources of outside information that this court would have to rely on, news media, National Weather Service, that type of thing, to help in the determination that this is a disaster.
Mr. Redding, are there any major differences between what's being proposed here and the ABA model rule?
I don't believe I can adequately answer that, but I know Keith could do that.
I will await his response.
Okay.
Any other questions of Mr. Redding? Thank you very much, Mr. Redding, not only for appearing on this petition and working through on this petition, but for all your other work on the Board of Administrative Oversight.
You're welcome.
Mr. Saleem.
Good morning, Chief Justice, Justices. I'm Keith Saleem, the Director of the Office of Lawyer Regulation. And I wanted also to commend the petition to you on behalf of our office. I would like to note that the State Bar also supports the adoption of the petition. The petition is based on the ABA model rule. I don't believe that there are any substantive distinctions, substantial distinctions. There is a concern that was raised by a memorandum from Ms. Owens regarding where the registrations should be filed. And the model rule refers to the clerk's office. Some other states have used the regulatory agency, and OLR is willing to have the registrations filed in our office or in the clerk's office as the court would see fit. The clerk may want to be asked about the clerk's preference also. There have been some changes made by the Legislative Reference Bureau to our petition as it's been prepared for you. And I was provided those last fall and responded to you by letter on November 14th or 17th, I believe. I have noted one item, very small item, since then that I did not bring to your attention at that time. With regard to the Legislative Reference Bureau's draft, if you look at 23.03 sub 2 sub B, it makes reference to legal services authorized under sub 1. And that creates some ambiguity in my mind because the legal services represented authorized under sub 1 would include disasters in another jurisdiction for which lawyers might be providing services under sub 3. And as a result, it could imply that the restrictions in sub 2 also apply to sub 3. In particular, I'm thinking about the limitations that the services be pro bono and provided under the supervision of a legal services agency, which should only apply in our intent under sub 2 of the rule and not sub 3. So I would suggest that the court may want to consider changing the language at the beginning of sub 2B to read legal services authorized under sub 2 sub A to make reference to that particular provision of the rule only. I think that would resolve the problem there.
I have a question, a couple of that. One, as I understand it now, the State Bar gets all of the lawyers, which includes judges, registration through payment of dues. And the State Bar, in effect, keeps the registration. That is, if I wanted to know who is a dues-paying bar member in good standing, I would look up the State Bar website.
Yes.
It's my understanding that your office and maybe other offices in the court system get that list.
We do get that list.
Okay.
It's downloaded into our database. Yes.
Pardon me?
It's transmitted to our database. Yes,
right.
We receive that.
Okay. So you can use it.
Yes.
If you have to. All right. Now, if this list is filed in the clerk's office or even filed in your office, it's not filed where everybody else is filed, which is in the state bar. And I have access to the state bar through the internet, state bar's list. I don't have access to your list, I don't think. Do I?
You have access to our list now through our new web search that was established in January, which should be a match with the state bar's list.
Okay.
You can access it on either website.
Probably. I thought that that list only showed these lawyers who were had discipline issues, but you're saying it's 100%. Okay.
Should be 100%.
All right. Then it makes sense to me to file this in your office because then there is a list. And then my next question to you is, does your list in effect, is that a substitute for the state bar list?
It would not be, Chief. And I also want to clarify the concern you raised with regard to the other list. The Pro Hoc Vice rule right now in 10.03 sub 4 provides that lawyers will file a copy of the of their application with OLR. They file the original application in the court in which they're seeking to appear.
That's right, and that's a circuit court generally.
That's generally a circuit court. That registration statement, as I understand it, is not provided to the state bar, and it is also not on either the bar's or OLR's website. We keep a list of that, and the court obviously has a list, but that's not currently on our website. You would not be able to search that right now.
What do you mean, the court? Do you get it from all 72 counties?
I receive it from the lawyer who's filed the Pro Hoc
okay.
application.
Right.
So the clerk in the circuit court would have it. Our office would have it. It would not be on anyone's website right now. And I expect, unless the court indicated a desire that these be available on the website, we would treat them similarly. We would have the registrations, but they would not be searchable unless the court indicated a desire to do that. I don't know that we would need to do that, but if I'm missing something, we'd be happy to make those arrangements and do it.
With regard to the Pro Hoc Vice you're talking about?
Either that or this particular registration under this rule.
Mm-hmm. Because it seems to me this rule does not cover court appearances. That is, there still would have to be the submission of a Pro Hoc Vice in order to appear before court. So we need some unified source of information so some judge in Trempealeau County can push on a button, if there still is a button in the middle of an emergency, mm-hmm. and get the information. So how is that going to work if we have a rule but no access to that information?
That information can be published and made available. We will be happy to do that. Otherwise, a person, a judge, or any other person who wanted to know would have to either contact the legal services agency if we're operating under sub 2 of the rule, or they would contact our office or the clerk's office wherever the registrations were filed and ask, and then that could be provided. But it could easily be put online. That would not be a problem for us to do at all.
One of the comments of concern regarding uniformity was submitted by Attorney Dean Dietrich, and he had, I think, what he labeled as major concerns about the LRB was making, in his opinion, significant changes to the language that would exist in proposed 2303, and therefore there would be problems with uniformity. Can you, in referencing the proposed rule, highlight for me his concerns, and also you apparently don't share those concerns, so let's have a discussion of that.
Thank you. I do not know Dean's concerns. When this came to my attention shortly after the court's request for information back last fall, and I received his email at the same time. I did have a discussion with him to ask him of his concerns. He indicated that he wanted to look further at the rule and then provide some comments, which he has not since then. So it's my understanding that the concerns that he saw, he has resolved for himself. So I'm not aware of any concerns that he has that remain with the text of the rule. And with regard, with the exception of the one item I raised with you this morning, I thought that perhaps could cause some ambiguity and might change the meaning of the rule. I think otherwise it comports with the draft that we had provided originally.
That leaves me in a quandary because it's a vacuum. Here's an attorney who the court often refers to with regard to the state bar's position.
Mm-hmm.
He often is here on behalf of the state bar and sometimes appears just as a volunteer individually because he has vast information about this. Now, I just don't know if silence means there's no concern. We have the email indicating, as I said, if I recall correctly, he used the phrase, I have major concerns. I might be wrong on that, but that's my recollection. And that sure causes me to pause. We also have a memo from our court commissioner that makes reference to Mr. Dietrich's concerns, and it says someplace that I agree with Dean Dietrich that substantive modifications to a proposed ABA model rule are not desirable. But beyond that, I don't know. So.
I can't help you beyond that, Justice Bradley.
Well,
I wish I could.
The commissioner gave us, it's in the court's binder 9, mm-hmm. Appendix A with red track changes that did some nice things, but they are not substantive, namely the instead of referring to this court, because, you know, this is an ABA model rule with minor, if any, modifications. And so it has to refer to this court because it's, there are 50 jurisdictions. So if the changes are instead of this court, the Wisconsin Supreme Court, because that's the court we're talking about. Instead of this jurisdiction, it's substituted the state of Wisconsin, which makes sense. Instead of paragraphs, it's sub Section 3, because that's our numbering system, and so on in this very long draft, and I don't see anything else other than that kind of change. Now, this rule runs typewritten, single space, a page and three quarters. The comments run almost two full pages, single-spaced, tightly written. That is an extremely long rule. I don't judge rules by their length, but it's way out of proportion to almost every other rule, if I'm right. And it's for events that you know hope will never happen, and if they happen are rare, we hope to. So I'm a little concerned about that, and I'm wondering whether, and this covers all sorts of things, covers emergency in the state, emergency out of the state, pro bono, not pro bono, wouldn't a rule be better that the Supreme Court, if the court declares an emergency or an emergency declared by the governor, but an emergency by the governor might not be one that affects the courts, could affect a number of things, but if it's declared that the Supreme Court can issue emergency rules for practice of law, and I'd leave it at that because I think movement of court is covered. I mean, do you know what I'm driving at? I just find that pouring through here and raising these issues seems a little long and tedious and may not fit the particular emergency that occurs. So what do you think of that?
The The issue for the court's judgment here is one of the practical necessity.
One, I think you better raise the podium.
Yeah.
Speak into the microphone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The issue here is the court's judgment of what decisions the court wants to make during the crisis. This particular petition addresses a very small, although significant, aspect of what may be needed during a major disaster. But if there's a major disaster in Wisconsin, it is only one of many things that will be affected that the government would be involved in and decisions that you would have to make. Chief Justice, you alluded to several other aspects mm-hmm. about the governor's authority or the conduct of our court's system. Mm-hmm. Our court has a critical incident management plan for how the court would operate in an emergency. There will be 101 things going on, 102 things on your docket. And the question then that you should think about is whether you want this to be one of them or not.
Mm-hmm. This, of course, is not during the emergency, not during the tornado, not during a fire. This is not the need for counsel is several days, maybe even weeks or months afterwards.
Of course.
And so it's not like it has to be done right that second.
While that is true, it is also true that the disruption caused by this disaster goes on for a long time.
Yes.
And there's an awful lot of work and a lot of problems that will have to be solved.
Right.
That will go on for a significant period of time.
Right.
So.
I agree that it's long, potentially long run, but that it is not immediate upon the occurrence of the disaster.
Right.
So there's a time frame in which other things will have to be handled, and this will have to be handled in a secondary or tertiary procedure.
Yes, Chief, I understand. I think you're correct.
Mr. Slynn, how does this coordinate or does it coordinate with anything the federal courts might be doing in a similar circumstance?
The federal courts would probably not have a significant interest in this because they do not regulate the practice of law within Wisconsin. They regulate the practice of law within their courts.
Right.
And so appearances in courts or the functioning of their courts, I don't think would be something that would affect the provision of legal services by lawyers who are not licensed in Wisconsin during a major disaster. They also control the authority to appear before them and have their own rules for that, which are independent of our rules.
I understand all of that. My question was really, are they doing something like this?
I'm sorry, I do not know.
You don't know. Okay.
Are you aware of the Uniform Law Commission, the Uniform Emergency Volunteer Health Protection Act? Did you come across that at all?
I have not looked at that, Your Honor. No.
That's an act that was promulgated almost on an emergency basis itself after Hurricane Katrina, and it applied to licensing, the same kind of thing that we have here, except it was healthcare providers, doctors, nurses, veterinarians. And Hurricane Katrina, the experience was that there were volunteers from many states who came to help, but they were denied the opportunity or delayed because they weren't initially licensed.
Right.
In the disaster area. And I think that Uniform Act with regard to emergency volunteer health care practitioners has been enacted in many states, but I'm not sure how that language would complement the language that we have before us, again, dealing with a different group of licensing, but still the same idea. That states license professionals, and in an emergency, there has to be some ability for professionals who are licensed in a particular state to be able to offer assistance. So it's the same rationale that underlies it. I have a question about this. Pro hoc vici, as I understand it, is filed only if the lawyer appears in court?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Well, by the time the lawyer appears in court, that lawyer has been representing that client for days, months, weeks, years.
Mm-hmm.
it's an out-of-state lawyer, I mean, by definition. Right?
Understood. Yes, that's correct.
And it's not licensed in Wisconsin?
That's also true.
So is that lawyer practicing law without a license? And it's only when the lawyer appears in court? And if that's true, what do we need this for? Because we have, as I understand this, every day there are lawyers giving legal advice, lawyers who are licensed outside the state, giving legal advice inside the state to counsel, to clients inside the state with legal problems inside the state. They are not licensed to practice law. We don't know who they are. They don't sign up pro hoc vici. They don't pay the fee. What are we doing about them?
There are provisions in Supreme Court Rule 20:5.5 that talk about
20:5.5
that provide for temporary practice of law in Wisconsin under limited circumstances. And
what's limited? Well, what about this one? They represent them for a couple of years,
right,
before they get to court.
Get to court. If the lawyer is representing someone and anticipates applying for pro hoc vice admission, mm-hmm, then that limited temporary practice of law is permitted by 5.5 for that purpose. The scope of the representations that we foresee in this rule go far beyond those circumstances where someone would ever be expected to appear in court. And they may relate to representations in the home jurisdiction rather than representations in Wisconsin, because persons are displaced to Wisconsin as a result of an emergency in a neighboring state or some other state.
I'm not making my point clear, and I'm sorry. My head has moved from an emergency. My head is on everyday Wisconsin.
Yes.
When it's bright and sunny.
We have a provision in 5.5 for, I'm sorry, in 10.03 for house counsel.
Wait a minute.
Counsel.
Tell me what that is again.
10.03, we have a house counsel rule. We have
This is not house counsel.
But
this is a member of a firm in Minnesota.
Right. I understand.
Practices law in Minnesota, licensed in Minnesota,
right,
and has a client in Eau Claire. Eau Claire resident, Eau Claire problem, Eau Claire state court. Case hasn't been filed yet.
Right.
Doing negotiating, advising the client, and they expect there's going to be a lawsuit.
Right.
Is that practicing law in Wisconsin?
It is, and it's authorized.
Pardon me?
It is, and it may be authorized by 5.5.
All right.
And so there's a pro hoc vice exception. There's an exception in 5.5 for lawyers who are temporarily in Wisconsin assisting a client for representation that occurs in the home state. So the litigation might be in Minnesota, for example, but there are depositions to be taken in Eau Claire. Client might be from Eau Claire. There are several situations in 5.5 where this is authorized based on very specific exceptions that are provided.
And this doesn't fall within those exceptions?
This contemplates a broader range of legal services, the rule that we're proposing, than I think is contemplated by 5.5. That being said, the critics of this rule in the handful of states that have rejected it have considered the adequacy of 5.5 for these situations, and some have felt it was worth consideration, others not. It was an item considered by the Minnesota court because they had the floods of the, I think it's the Platte or the Missouri River by the North Dakota border, and they were able to handle that emergency adequately under 5.5. So that argument was made in Minnesota that they don't need the rule. Minnesota adopted it anyway.
Yeah, that's what's bothering me. It
right.
just seems to me if you're not in court, we don't really regulate you. You can cross the border anytime.
I think that 5.5 is a rule that has not been interpreted by this court or many courts regarding the scope of those temporary services that are provided.
5.5 is the unauthorized practice of law.
Yes. And so,
that's an issue.
That's an issue.
Right. Here you have, in my example, you got licensed lawyers doing Wisconsin business.
We would have unlicensed lawyers in Wisconsin doing business.
Right.
That fits into one of those exceptions.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the question is whether those exceptions are broad enough for the emergency situation proposed by this rule.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe that they are entirely so, although I believe that in some situations they would be adequate for some legal services provided mm-hmm. in an emergency.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Saleem.
Thank you.
Are there any other people who wish to appear on this matter? I have none listed. There are no other appearances. Ms. Rich, have we gotten any communications other than from Mr. Diedrich? I don't have any. Okay. The hearing on 11-07 in the matter of the petition to create a Supreme Court rule for legal services following a major disaster is now closed. I will turn to 11-09 in the matter of the petition to amend Supreme Court Rule 60.041G relating to ex parte communications in treatment courts. We have co-presenters of Judge Elliot Levine of La Crosse County and Judge Catherine Foster of Waukesha County. And I have no other appearances registered. If anyone else wishes to appear, please give your name to the marshal. Judge?
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to see you all again. As Judge Foster is here with me to present the change in the requested change in the ethics rules on ex parte communication in treatment courts. Also, Judge Stark happens to be in town and is also another one of the course treatment court judges across the state. The petition does explain fairly well what the reasoning is for the request for the change, which is a modeling of the ABA rule with a slight change in some of the language from a comment from the ABA rule. As you know, a couple of years ago, there was a request that we form an ad hoc committee to look at issues pertaining to treatment courts, specifically on the issues of confidentiality, record keeping, and ex parte communication of treatment court judges who are running these type of courts. We just had the State Association just had a conference last week. Every conference we ask how many treatment courts out there. We take a new tally. We are now up to 51.
Hmm. Are they all put registered or noted? I shouldn't say registered. You don't have to register. We're on our website?
We're getting the information. Shelley Fox is there. We have all the information. We've gathered all. The two newest ones are the Ho-Chunk Tribe has an implementation grant, is now functioning with the Jackson County courts, and Sparta, or excuse me, Monroe County, has re-initiated an OWI treatment court. So those are the 50-51 markers. It's approximately about 40 counties. Many counties have multiple courts operating, as many of you know.
That's more than half the counties.
Yeah, more than half the counties do have operational treatment courts at this point in time. I don't know how much more detail, because I know many of you have seen the courts operate, seen how they function. Judge Gableman, or Justice Gableman, you are involved with the creation of one. In fact, Jenny Ingram is the current president of the association right now. The main thing about this is what I need to explain is that, as you know in the model, and I don't know of how many of you sat in the team meetings before the treatment court. This is really a two-part system. One is the team meeting. That's the important part of the team meeting, which is part of the 10 key components that we need to follow in order to have effective courts, requires that a judge be there and all the various roles that are particular the district attorney's office, public defender's office, or a defense role individual who's there. Department of Corrections is usually represented. Treatment providers, coordinator, of course, who brings all the information before us. Law enforcement, those are all the possible different roles that would be there. The goal, of course, is to have as many of these roles at the table of the team meeting. Before a person actually participates in a treatment court, of course, they have to sign an agreement to participate. It's a voluntary program. As one of the appendices to the report that we had put out before, if you look at page 27, paragraph 8, is an example of a waiver of the ex parte relationship. Now, this is in the report that we put out in November 2011.
That report is not in the binders and not needed. That report, as I remember, went through PPAC, is that right?
That's correct.
And was approved or adopted, I've forgotten the technical word we used.
That best practices report was approved by EJS and approved by PPAC. The subcommittee that worked on it was not only the three of us who are here, but also three other treatment court judges. Actually, there was even more judges, I think, who piped in during the process that we were putting that report together. And
it's a best practices report.
That's a best practices report.
Okay.
One of the recommendations is this additional rule on ex parte communication in treatment courts. So, yes, it has been before EJS, it's been before PPAC, and during one of the PPAC meetings, we did vet this to the state bar, state public defender's office, district attorneys, Wisconsin Association of Treatment Court Professionals, and then basically anybody else who would look at it. We felt it was important to vet it among as many people as possible. The rule itself, I'm going to have Judge Foster talk about the change and what we're proposing here. What I think is important for you to understand is that this, right now, treatment courts have been operational with these waivers in place, which the participants sign, and they do it knowingly, and have felt all along that we could function that way. But for those who don't know my background, I was involved with the original creation of the La Crosse Drug Court back in 2000. You know, for the last 16 years, we've had courts in the state of Wisconsin, starting with Dane County and then eventually out of 51 courts. Over that time, I should say that some judges were hesitant over this issue of ex parte communication, and obviously many judges felt the waiver was an appropriate way to deal with this issue. But we do believe that this clarifies this and makes it clear for judges who want to participate in this but for some reason are hesitant for that reason. What I'm going to do is I'm going to allow, at this point, we have Judge Foster talk more about the substance of the rule change, unless there's some questions for me specifically about the courts and how they're operating.
Judge Levine, I was curious about whether this would apply to veterans courts. I see you say problem-solving courts, so I assume it would apply to that as well as a drug treatment court.
We use the term treatment courts or problem-solving courts as a general term to incorporate all the various variations. Part of the problem is every county, every district is individualized for that population, right? So it is a little difficult. I mean, we have an adult drug court in La Crosse County. We have an OWI treatment court, and we have a veterans court, which is relatively new. Mm-hmm. Eau Claire County has that and a mental health court. Waukesha County has OWI court and adult drug court. Mm-hmm. So, yes, it will incorporate veterans courts. Any court that's designed around those 10 key components really is pretty much incorporated with that.
Okay, thank you.
And treatment courts yet unheard of.
What?
I said, and treatment courts yet unheard of.
Yeah. Yeah, that's correct. You never know exactly what other models will be I should say, though, just to make sure it's clear, that treatment courts are based on research-based evidence that we have. In other words, this procedure of having a judge sit on a team is very much supported by the research and the evidence that we have out there at this point. Dr. Marlowe was at our treatment court conference this last week. Doug Marlowe is probably one of the top preeminent researchers in this field. And the importance of judicial interaction is one of the greatest reasons why they are successful. The relationship between the judge and the participant is, for those of us who have done it, quite honestly, is one of the most fulfilling things about being part of a treatment court and seeing those changes and that true progress you see individuals do. But we also know that there's something special about having that relationship. You need the judge in the coordinating team meeting in order to understand what's going on with the participant.
I'm sure, Judge Levine, you've seen the National Center report on its discussion of our effective justice strategies, including these courts.
Yeah, and that was very much part of the development that is part of the EJS, the National Center for State Courts report, which just got out.
I know. It looks pretty, too.
Yeah, it does look
as
nice.
As well as it's a good report. So and one of the things in that report, as I read it, which I know you've favored, is to try and get some uniformity and best practice goals.
Right, and to add a little extra information about that is we have formed part of the Wisconsin Treatment Court Association. There is a group of us. Judge Stark is on this group. Judge Foster has helped along, and then Shelley Fox has helped from the Director of State Courts, is to develop standard practices. And there's also the other development that the Director of State Courts has made a request for a grant from the Bureau of Justice, BJA, to develop performance measures specifically for adult drug courts and hybrid courts, which is the mixture of adult drug courts and OWI cases.
You know, one of the things, we always say drug courts or mental health courts or veterans courts. That, of course, is not correct terminology, but we all use it, including me, yeah. And I gulp, because these are not specialized courts. These are drug court proceedings within the circuit court. So, but for purposes of a formal provision, I would like it to be said, when serving on therapeutic or problem-solving court programs, mental health court programs, treatment court programs, you don't like programs, something else, because they are not courts. We only have one trial court. Other than the municipal court, which is a circuit court, right?
And changing the language slightly, what you're suggesting is we change the language there rather than. And I have to say that language is specifically the language from the ABA.
I know, but it's not our terminology.
And you are identifying one of the more complicated ways is how do we identify these courts in a way that's not exclusive, but. You're exactly, I think you're right that it should probably say court programs. It
won't change anything substantively,
right. But
it does raise issues in terms of we don't set up specialized courts.
Right.
Usually handled by the criminal, whoever is sitting in the quote criminal court, which
right. Is
a circuit court.
Although right now, for example, there's a family court in Milwaukee County, which is purely CHIPS cases, and there's, of course, the case.
And that's assigned in the branches, but it's a circuit court.
Right, right.
All right, well, let's think about that, okay?
Okay, yeah, that's a simple change.
Simple change. It's not substantive, and it just makes it clearer.
Right.
Partially because when people come in from out of state, like the National Center, and you talk to them about courts, they visualize these specialized courts. And it takes a while for them to be redoctrinated that this is a circuit court. usually sitting in criminal jurisdiction, and this is part of their programming procedures. So,
and I think one of the big advantages we have in the state of Wisconsin is that we're a unified court system.
That's right.
Where many of these models come from jurisdictions that don't have unified
That's
court
right.
system.
And I don't want to get off on a different track.
Right.
So thank you. Any other questions of Judge Levine? And then, if not, we'll hear from Judge Foster. I'm sorry, Justice Prosser.
If I have the right language, it includes knowingly waived by a participant?
Yes.
How describe the waiver for me?
Well, actually, the contract, it's usually done in the form of the overall contract that we have. And there's an example contract. And actually, you raised something that Judge Stark and Judge Foster and I were just talking about, is that one of the best practices is that should we develop a colloquy for a best practice in the part of the contract part when somebody starts as a participant. Usually there's an initial first time that they come, they observe the courts, they are formally welcomed into courts. Many adult drug courts sometimes formalize the petition signing, the contract signing, basically. And I think it's in that process that question about, you understand there's going to be ex parte communication, that you're participating in this. Now, I must admit that because there has been no uniform sort of approach to this, and this is why we're developing these programs, is that various courts do it various ways right now. For example, many courts have their coordinators review these contracts with them. And if you look at it, they not only waive their ex parte communication, but they also waive confidentiality. There's a lot of various waivers, so all the information can be gathered.
Does that waiver go to the lawyers, too? Because the lawyers may be waiving confidential information.
Right. In most drug court cases, because you're also talking about this being in conjunction with the plea agreement, that it's going along with a statement negotiated plea. It's going along with the other waivers and contracts that you have to sign in order to be part of the court. It's not in and of itself just, welcome to drug court here, sign this. It's never that easy. It's always a lot more complicated. Now, I must say that in our OWI court, we give people the option. They meet with their attorneys, gone over what it means to participate in the OWI, our OWI treatment court, and then the coordinator goes over the contract with it. But there is a best practice question about should there be a colloquy of some sort before the judge as the person starts.
So. Next question is, why is it only knowing, not knowing, intelligent, and voluntary?
Because again, we were following the rule. We were following the ABA rule. And except, actually, I must say that the waiver part was something, because the ABA rule envisioned some statutory structure that many of these courts exist in. I'm sort of taking this Judge Foster's part here.
Her thunder.
I'm stealing her thunder a little bit, but the fact is, I agree that. We didn't add that language. We could add that language. We hopefully it is intelligently, knowing, voluntary, and intelligently done. I was just taking a quick look at the draft example. If we use that term, but we don't. Now this is a draft example that we have. But again, these are examples of what type of
in content. Your best practice.
That's correct. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
There has been a lot of discussion about these special treatment courts in recent years, especially at judicial conferences. Has there been any litigation that actually has come out and involved the treatment court?
You know, There's no litigation in the state of Wisconsin. Obviously, that's been appealed up. Other than other states, where yes, there has been litigation in other states on various issues, but there hasn't been anything in the state of Wisconsin that has come up. If there is, at a trial court level, Justice Prosser, it's possible that there has been contested expulsion hearings, which we've had, but that's been the extent of the litigation I've seen. Generally, I should say different courts have different due process requirements for various parts of it. We do make a suggestion in here, but that's the extent that I've seen.
What's the issue in other states?
I can specifically think of, and I'm going to turn to Marcia, and I think Florida had some cases that came up. And it's not specifically about this. It was not about ex parte issues. It was issues more about due process within expulsion, which came up.
Expulsion from the drug court
from
program.
From the courts themselves, right.
Which puts them back into whatever stage of criminal proceedings they were.
Right, and that's correct. Expulsion, usually, many of these are predisposition, some of them are post-disposition, some are post-disposition with imposed and stayed sentences. Each county develops their own structural system to deal with it. Part of that is because you want it to be able to address whatever population that you believe is appropriate for your county. This is the ultimate locality issue of knowing what your population is and developing what your course should be.
Okay. Let's hear from Judge Foster. Thank you.
Thank you.
Judge Levine. Judge, not only for this, but for all your work on the treatment courts and for your work on the best practices manual, which was very extensive. Thank you. Judge Foster.
Thank you, Justice. I think I want to simply start off by picking up where Judge Elliott left off, since I had a moment to gather the paperwork, and in response to Justice Prosser's question about the waiver. I apologize. I know it's not good practice necessarily to read, but the waiver that's recommended in the report is relatively brief. And it's really two sentences, and it reads, I understand that the judge may initiate, permit, or consider ex parte communications with members of the treatment court team at team meetings / staffings or by written documents provided to all members of the treatment court team. I understand that this means that even when I am not present, the judge may discuss me and learn or review any information about me that could affect my participation in treatment court. So there is the one legalese, obviously, ex parte communication, but then the second sentence, I think, explains that in relatively plain English. This particular waiver isn't the creation of any of the individuals here. I believe it was drafted originally by the National Association of Treatment Court Professionals, that really anybody that starts a treatment court is strongly encouraged to borrow from. In fact, they make all of their documents, forms, communication, publications available free of charge through their website. And so that was included in the report that's already been mentioned. And that is the waiver that is referenced in our proposed rule change here today. And the rule change, also in keeping with some of the questions that have already been asked, is a Wisconsin version of the Model Judicial Code of Conduct from the ADA in 2007. And the ADA code, it's number 2.9, that is reflected in our own 60.04, the general rule and prohibition against ex parte communication. In the model rule, which has actually been adopted in at least seven states in the country, the amendment that we are seeking here today is referenced in a comment to the model rule. And that comment references a judge may initiate, permit, or consider ex parte communications expressly authorized by law, which is something that is already reflected in our code. The problem in Wisconsin, if you will, is not that we have a problem in ex parte communication. It's that we don't have any express authorization by the legislature for our special treatment court docket. And I'm going to propose that if we make a change, we would reference the docket as opposed to a program.
That's a good idea.
That's actually not mine. I'm reminded by that by my colleague seated next to me, and it is the word used by our presenter last week, our national presenter, Dr. Marlowe. And I think if Justice Abramson, you referenced people coming from out of state to look at our program, I think that that is the word used nationally.
Good.
And it's a good reflection of that these aren't specialty courts per se. It is a special docket within an existing court. So,
helps me, and in the various speeches I give, I always stumble around. The first time I say program, but then afterwards I say court. Okay, good.
All right. Bottom line today, because we don't have that express authorization, our proposal would be a new paragraph. It would be in the text of the rule itself and not in the comment like the model rule, and it would be basically exception six to the rule against ex parte communication, that a judge may initiate, permit, engage in, or consider ex parte communications knowingly waived by a participant, and that knowing waiver would be the form I started out with here a few moments ago, when serving on therapeutic or problem-solving courts, mental health courts, or treatment courts. And the national model would specifically reflect that veterans courts, family courts, anybody that follows that 10-key component national model or hopefully a very close resemblance to that would fall in that category. We spent a lot of time actually crafting and debating that subject on our committee. For what it's worth, my personal opinion is calling it a problem-solving court is inappropriate because I think I problem-solve every day on the bench. I think all of you do. And that's what courts do. We resolve problems. But we don't always do it in a therapeutic fashion, and we don't always target a particular group of individuals and needs in a special docket. So that's what I think is unique about this process.
Why don't you have the word including rather than why isn't a mental health court a therapeutic or problem-solving court?
I don't think I have a ready answer for that, except that that is the ABA code. That's the portion that we kept, clearly, from the ABA code.
It seems to me that it should say when serving on therapeutic or problem-solving court dockets, including mental health court dockets, treatment court dockets. If you wanted to add veteran or alcohol, I don't care. But
I'm just recalling my basic law about statutory construction, and and I think the concern is always if you give an example that you aren't excluding other, we're obviously trying to be as inclusive.
I know. When you say including in Wisconsin, it says that means it's not exclusive. And if you don't say other courts, that's okay.
So you would like the language, if I understand correctly, when serving on therapeutic or problem-solving courts,
dockets.
Semicolon, including dockets. Thank you.
Including mental health court dockets. Want to put veteran court dockets, alcohol court dockets. I don't care.
Or other similar treatment courts?
Yeah.
All right.
How do you serve on a docket?
That's a good question, Justice. Maybe it should be assigned.
That's
our assignment. If I understand Justice Prosser's question, he's referencing the word when serving on. When assigned to a docket, since we clearly are assigned.
I certainly was not trying to create problems with the rule draft, but of course, when we talk about plea colloquies, I find that we have extensive plea colloquies in part because we have no faith in the written document that is signed between the attorney and the client. I can't remember what it's called. But, do you foresee any situation in which a defendant, however you refer to that person, would say, "Oh, I really didn't understand this," and challenge it? I mean, should we be concerned about the formality of the waiver, or is that just kind of searching for a problem that doesn't exist?
Well, I think we should always be concerned. I don't think we take any of this less than very seriously. But my basic understanding is that every defendant that comes into a treatment court has had counsel, regardless of the kind of court. There may, of course, be an exception, but because the mantra is high risk, high need individual, that usually translates into a serious charge, especially if we're talking in the criminal genre. I can't speak precisely to the family court issues, but I think family court issues, we're talking about people in risk of losing their parental rights, so very serious matters that they are allowed counsel. And the other reason I don't think we have voluntary in here is every participant volunteers to be in the program. So we have all of those elements. The question posed earlier about intelligently waiving, that I think is a little trickier, especially if you're talking about a drug use population, because the additional model is you want somebody early on in the process while they are receptive to change, and receptive and sick and tired of what the lifestyle they may be leaving behind, and more amenable to successful treatment. And that may mean that their mind is not cleared of the drugs. Their mind is the scrambled eggs frying on the hot sidewalk in the old commercials. So the degree that they intelligently waive may be called into question at some point. But the simple answer, I think, to your question is if they didn't think that this is what they were getting into, they withdraw. There is no immediate consequence for withdrawing other than that which they were going to face when the original charges were issued. Then they agreed to in part of the plea colloquy, because this would be and has been incorporated, so to speak, into the plea colloquy before court would accept their plea and in effect allow them to even go into a treatment court docket.
So you want to leave it knowing, you don't want to add intelligent and voluntary.
I don't.
Let me see something else. First of all, I come with an abundance of appreciation for you and others who have spearheaded this movement, if I may use that term here, in Wisconsin. And although I am what I would call an enthusiastic supporter and have attended some of these, I'm not really up on all of the words. I don't know all of the literature. So that's with that premise, I start my question. I look at the words in this proposed rule, and I'm going to use just for ease of discussion the term court, realizing we don't have specialty courts. So we have here, it says, serving or assigned to, whatever we decide, on therapeutic or problem-solving courts. So we have a therapeutic court. We have a problem-solving court, mental health courts, or treatment courts. So we've got four courts designated. Now, this is what I started with in my confession of ignorance. To me, a mental health court, the only specifically named court in this list, is also a therapeutic court, a problem-solving court, and a treatment court. And so we've got all these labels. Are there any differences? I mean, for me, again, not being up on everything, an OWI court would be a therapeutic court, a problem-solving court, or a treatment court. So I don't quite understand, for instance, if mental health is, as I think, it's also a therapeutic, a problem-solving, or a treatment court, why it's listed by itself. I don't understand the difference between therapeutic, problem-solving, and treatment, because for me, they're all lumped together. I could use just one word to cover all of the stuff we've talked about. I just don't know the differences. So could you help me on that?
Sure. It's not ignorance by any means, Justice. I think it's the correct perception that in many respects there aren't any, because participants in whatever type of program you talk about generally has multiple problems. It may start with a drug issue, or it may start with a mental health problem that is self-medicated, and because of all that, they have all these other problems. They may not have custody of their children, or they may not be paying child support and exercising their periods of physical placement. They may have alcohol and drug problems. They run the gambit. And I think singling these out as examples and trying to be as inclusive, these are really reflective of what an individual county may categorize as a need. Who's in their jail? How can you reduce costs to pay for the program and receive a benefit? Because, of course, not only are there federal dollars engaged in these programs, but a lot of county dollars, and hopefully eventually all county dollars will be devoted, and perhaps some state. And so it's really a title. It may be that you say, I'll use our own example, our alcohol treatment court. We have a significant population within that court that, A, has significant mental health problems. Now, they may not be in a Chapter 51 proceeding, but they clearly need mental health care. And or were never convicted. One of our first graduates never drinks. She was using drugs. So she was an impaired driving. She was under the influence of drugs. Now, was she appropriate for our alcohol treatment court? Yes, because the process is the same in terms of what they need to do from a systematic approach to gain recovery and compliance. So I think it's not ignorance. I think it's a reflection, really, of what goes on in the respective court, regardless of what title you put on the docket.
So why do we need all of these words? I just throw it out because sometimes words help, but sometimes they complicate. We mentioned mental health court here, but we don't mention some of the other courts, you know, that we're dealing with veterans and OWIs. Why not just when serving on therapeutic or when assigned to a therapeutic or problem-solving court dockets? Does that cover everything? Is there a need to have more words in describing the courts? What's better? Any thoughts on that, Judge?
I think the cliche, reasonable minds can disagree. And, you know, you or I may disagree, or I may disagree with mm-hmm. my fellow treatment court judges. Do we need more words? Do we need less words? I'm a less word person.
Mm-hmm. My sense is...
So whatever it takes, I guess, to accomplish
my sense is
the change is
you took
fine.
You took a look at the comment of the ABA that had a lot of this stuff in, but you didn't follow it exactly. In fact, you improved it immensely, but then you left some of this what I would call stuff in because that's safe, you know, because it's a model, you know, well, it's part of the comment, and I understand that. So, okay.
Does the word including help you? Do it with a therapeutic or problem-solving courts and then say, including mental health, alcohol treatment dockets, veterans, et cetera.
Well, it could. I think that there might be new, what we would refer to as specialty courts. As I understand it right now in Green Bay, there is a seminar on family law, I think. Maybe someone can help me. And one of the issues that might be addressed is at that seminar is how you can do the mental health component in family law cases, not CHIPS cases, not juvenile cases, but, you know, divorce cases. And so there's, you know, everything comes new under the sun. And that's why my sense was maybe more umbrella language than specific language. And as I said, I didn't really understand, and I don't, the differences between some of these umbrella words, if they really are different. My sense is there's not too much of a difference between them. But that's, reasonable minds can differ. And if my premise is both you and I are reasonable, which I hope is true, at least I know you are, well, we can go from there then. Thank you.
Anything else, Judge Foster?
No, not if you don't.
Any other questions? Hearing none, you are, I think, the only person listed. Does anyone else wish to make an appearance on this? Well, I was not going to let Judge Stark come all the way from Eau Claire and not have her speak, whether she wanted to or not. Judge Stark.
I actually had not planned to speak. I am in town for something else, but I wanted to...
Your explanation is accepted.
You listen in on this. And I wanted to respond to Justice Bradley's question. The difficulty with an exception, of course, is you don't want to swallow the rule. And if we didn't delineate that we were talking about therapeutic or problem-solving dockets, and then tried to give a little bit better explanation, including mental health dockets, and I liked the changes in the wording that have been proposed, or other treatment dockets, we might then be swallowing up the rule prohibiting ex parte communications in regular family law situations. There are family law courts. There are worthless check courts. There are domestic violence courts. There are all kinds of different types of treatment dockets that have arisen. Some relate to the 10 key components that are used in an OWI drug court, therapeutic court situation. The mental health court is accepted out here in part because it has 10 key components, but they're slightly different. And I don't work in our mental health court, so I can't tell you what those differences are, but my understanding is they're slightly different, which is why there's an exception for including that specifically, but also because you don't want to swallow up a typical Chapter 51 proceeding, for example, into this idea. And so there is some rationale for delineating this with some specific wording rather than just pushing it all together to problem-solving or therapeutic courts. Judge Foster's comment that what we all try to do in great measure is problem-solve, I think is appropriate here, and we don't want to lose the ex-parte prohibition.
Yeah, maybe something that would help this rule, and I don't know quite the wording of it, but I take your comments as well-placed. Maybe something in the rule should say to which the person being treated or however you want to label the public participant volunteers so that it's a treatment court to which someone volunteers or a mental health court or a family court, some kind of specialty court. I mean, you'd have to use words that are better than what I'm trying to do sitting here. But I think you could label it a particular kind of problem-solving court because of the voluntary aspects of participation in that docket.
And that's a really good idea. The only concern I would have, knowing how the courts function, is that it's voluntary to come in, and you know what you're getting into before you come in, because there's not a court I'm aware of, at least in Wisconsin, where they don't spell out for you all the things you're waiving and all the requirements of the court before you come in, so you know what you're getting into. But once you're in, you don't just get to say, well, I'm going to do this, and I'm not going to do that, and I'm going to walk away if I don't like what you're doing. They can leave, certainly, but that has the consequences associated with whatever part of the proceeding they were at the time. And so just putting the word voluntary in makes me a little
nervous. I think the wording has to take into account what you're talking about, because surely once you're in, the whole program is not you do what you want to do. You do what's recommended. But there's got to be a way of saying in a way that the person who comes into the court initially voluntarily decides to enter this program.
And that's a good point, because these other courts, like a Chapter 51 proceeding or some of those certainly are not voluntary.
No, it's not whether you volunteer. It's the nature of the proceeding. For example, what has been labeled veteran court dockets, in many of them, although there aren't that many to begin with, but many of them do not fit the alcohol, mental health, and other treatment courts because they are a mentoring court.
Correct.
So that the judge assigns, if the guy agrees, the judge assigns a mentor. That's not the same. We call it a veterans court, but it is not of the same ilk as the others. So to define therapeutic or problem-solving courts, it would be in terms of the group, a group getting together. Now, there must be a definition of that, whether it's in best practices or in the drug professionals who will describe what the drug court is. It's the distinguishing factor of this and the distinguishing factor for ex parte is what you have is a group of people meeting with the judge, telling the judge things the judge would not otherwise hear. So the veteran, I picked veteran, but you could pick something else. Some of the veteran programs fit within that, where the group does meet with the veteran. But others are a mentoring program or some other, or a diversion into a federal treatment system, which is not the same thing as this. So I think that if you're going to do what Justice Bradley suggested of therapeutic or problem solving and you want to define that into a specialty, I think you define it in terms of the concept of groups meeting. Now, that's not good enough, but I'm sure there's a definition in there that will handle that, or you can take it from some comment, because that's the distinguishing factor. Otherwise, you wouldn't need the ex parte. You need ex parte because the judge is talking to people.
Does the second sentence deal with that, though? Because after talking about those courts, it makes it clear what the purpose is, and that is in this capacity, judges may assume a more interactive role with participants, treatment providers, probation officers,
you
social
just
workers,
do that,
and
but,
others.
But you would define problem-solving courts or therapeutic court dockets as dockets in which judges assume a more interactive role. I mean, right. That's exactly what I think has to be done. It just has to be tied up that way.
Clarifying what's encompassed within it. And that really is the key.
It is the key. Otherwise, you don't need anything on ex parte.
Correct.
And that some veterans, I'm sorry, I keep picking veterans because that's the last thing I dealt with, are fitted. And on the mental health, we have so few. There's one in Eau Claire, as I remember.
That's the only one right now.
And that's the only one. I think someone else was starting one. I've forgotten what county that was in. But dealing with the Eau Claire judge who's running that. But even that one, I assume, has the interactive role, even if it has different.
Actually, I will tell you that Judge Lenz, who runs that court, is quite uncomfortable with that interactive role, and I haven't spoken to him specifically about this rule change, but I think this would
help him
with some of his concerns.
Yeah, but then I would knock out the mental health because that has its own specialties, but they all have their own little kickers in it. DV courts are run like, some DV courts are run like therapeutic problem solving, and others are run like strict criminal courts, as I understand it.
So what I'm understanding you're saying is leaving the first sentence as we've discussed, modifying it, but then qualifying the therapeutic or problem-solving dockets to mean
those in which
judges assume
dockets
a more.
Dockets in which, yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Then you've got it tied down. I think that would do it. I mean, until you draft, you don't know, but I think that's the theme.
Thank you.
I gather that you think that might work.
I do, unless my colleagues have some significant concerns, and I would say.
Judge Levine is going to talk. He has to come to the microphone.
I was just going to try to make a suggestion, and Marcia was just suggesting that these are all, just so you know, all these comments about the language. We actually had many of that discussion
in
the committee. And in fact, the same concerns you've all raised are pretty much exactly the same concerns we've had. They're sort of like, well, we know this is the model. Let's suggest that at first. What I would like to say is that if you want us to redraft it with all these concerns, I would suggest that we collect these ideas and then let us redraft it, repropose it.
What we could probably do, Mr. LeCour.
Because I think these are all valid concerns. And this struggle about what word you use, how do you describe this in a way that's appropriate, I can tell you that nationally it is a struggle. How do you describe this issue? So.
Sure.
Anyway, I just was going to propose that we're discussing that as a procedurally how we maybe can proceed from this point to, rather than having you try to reformulate it in your conference, but allow us to try to
do it. We would do it badly, Judge.
Right. What?
We would do it badly.
I am not suggesting that at all.
All right.
I take every word you say to the T.
Thank you.
I did do some drafting, but I'm not wedded to it. A judge may initiate, permit, engage, or consider ex parte communications when dealing with a person who has agreed to participate in a specialized, and I haven't quite got the words, treatment docket or specialized therapeutic and problem-solving docket and has knowingly waived objection to such ex parte communications in relation to his participation. His or her participation.
And what we could do is take that language and we'll that seems to incorporate many of the ideas that we've talked about and try to incorporate them into reworking that.
And certainly
you can
add
get
the second
a tape. Sentence. You can get a tape on that.
Yeah.
Not a tape.
And I have to say that this is an ongoing issue. Obviously, every time we develop these issues, what we find is that there's always something new that something has come up out there. For example, I was just going to point out, vets court, for example, didn't exist when the ABA model was created. And so nobody anticipated that variation at that point in time. So.
And there will be others.
There will always be others.
Could I ask one more question? Can you anticipate any other kind of specialized treatment court that we don't have in Wisconsin? I want to be ahead of the curve, make news today.
Let me give you one thing, which I don't mean to contradict the Chief Justice, but one
good idea.
Yeah. One thing is that the Veterans Court actual model has an interesting part to it, which is the mentor aspect. And I don't think this is going to necessarily be a different type of court, but there may be an added interesting component about concept of mentoring in alliance with various types of courts. And that is a variation which I could see a development in the future. One thing we experienced in La Crosse County when we developed our initially veterans mentoring program and then eventually Judge Bjerke developed the Veterans Court is that we saw a lot of use for the mentoring part of this and as a connection to the courts. Now, that's not a new court per se, but it is a variation that I can see learning from this other model that other models will see and say, we should incorporate that. For example, we're talking about that in our OWI court model right now.
But the initial mentoring, would you consider that a treatment court?
No.
Standing alone. That's my point.
Yeah. The initial mentoring is not a treatment court.
That's right. That's my point.
It's an additional sort of program structure.
That's right. It's like victim impact programs or comparable ones. So that's all. Well, what you see is in the juvenile system, the use of treatment courts, treatment dockets. So I think you're going to see in coming years juvenile mental health treatment dockets. I think you might see, we've got some, maybe it's in Waukesha County, I just don't always remember the county, a juvenile a drug treatment.
There's two in the country.
There are two?
Yeah.
So, I mean, but those are just beginning. that are easily on the horizon. I would, there's funding available now for Indian, for tribal courts in mental health and in drugs and in alcohol. I would not be surprised to see coordinate programs between tribes and the circuit courts on these programs because there'd be use of treatment providers and there'd be funding for them. So I think that, I think we're going to see regional treatment programs because we don't have enough people and enough money and facilities in any one county, I would say, especially in our less populated counties. So I think you're going to see a lot of different kinds of models.
Yeah. And all those models are very much alive in Wisconsin right now.
In thought, anyway.
Yeah. Well, for example, Burnett Washburn County was one of the first, and St. Croix Tribes was the very first multi-jurisdictional group that I knew of in the state. The Ho-Chunk-Jackson County relationship is relatively new. I know that up in Ashland County and the Red Cliff tribe is looking at a potential joint jurisdictional operation. Now,
that with Judge Anderson?
Yeah, I believe so. That one I'm not. I just heard about that recently. So there's a I totally agree. There's actually a fair amount of funds through BIA for tribes, and we're going to see more development of that as tribes take on more of their jurisdictional authority in some of those tribal nations. So,
any other comments or questions? All right. Thank you, Judge Levine. Thank you, Judge Stark. Thank you, Judge Foster. Does anyone wish to appear on 11-09? Not hearing or seeing anyone, that will close the hearing on 11-09 in the matter of the petition to amend Supreme Court Rule 60-04-1G relating to ex-party communications and treatment. Courts, the court is adjourned in its open hearing. It will reconvene in open administrative conference in about 5 minutes.